All right, I'm going to try this without the mic. Can everyone hear me okay if I put this down? I'm pretty good at being loud. So thank you for the introduction, Dr. Schmidt. Thank you all for having me. It's fun for me to be here. The majority of what I do right now is travel around and teach. So I'm going to go ahead and apologize because normally I teach an 8.5 hour course, and I tried to consolidate a lot of the best information down to an hour, so it's really tough. So there's going to be a lot of information that I'm going to be going through today. But I'll have some lab sessions in the afternoon, so I can definitely address more in those. So I'm Ben. I'm a PT here locally. I've had the chance to work with Johnny Owens ever since I was a student. I actually shadowed under Johnny before I got into PT school, and he was here in San Antonio at the Center for the Intrepid over on Fort Sam. So for anyone that's not familiar with the CFI, this is kind of the crown jewel for rehab for the military. It's about a $60 million rehab facility for severely wounded. Johnny got brought in for sports medicine and orthopedics because that was his background, and that was right at the beginning of OIF and OEF. And his role very quickly changed to not only sports medicine and orthopedics, but also dealing with trauma and limb salvage because of all the injuries coming back from war. So that's a big part of what drove this forward. So we're going to dive into a little bit of the history of that, and then we'll talk about kind of big picture application and where we see this really filling a role for us in rehab and changing some of what we can do as far as outcomes in our mind, and then talk about safety and best practices, and that'll pretty much fill up the hour. So looking at Fort Sam Houston, or you know, SAMC, what used to be BAMC, you've got the big military hospital there that's the largest military hospital in the country. They're dealing with a lot of the trauma right after it comes back stateside. And then we've got the ISR right next to that. So you got all three of these places right in close proximity to each other. The ISR is where the big burn treatment facility is, but it's also where a lot of the physiology research is done for the military. So between these three places, they really had to find some new solutions to the injuries coming from wartime. And that's one of the things we see historically is we have to really improve what we're doing in wartime because the injuries are more severe and there's more of them. So looking at that, there's three populations that really highlighted a need for doing something better and something different. So looking at those, the first of those was the limb salvage population, or what we thought of as the high energy lower extremity trauma group, the HELIT group. So it's these individuals that were blown up downrange, a lot of the IEDs or gunshot wounds. You have this big trauma that's gonna, typically go to Germany and get a fixation, then it's gonna come back stateside, and they're gonna, play with the fixation a little bit, refine it. And Johnny was given this population in a broom closet at first, and they're like, all right, figure it out. Get these guys back to function, back to active duty, or to where they can be discharged with a pretty good quality of life. And so looking at that, about a year to 2 years out from that initial injury, this is a pretty typical presentation for that limb right up here. So we've got a limb that's pretty weak and painful. For the military guys and gals, they determine function by whether or not they can run. And a lot of these people going through limb salvage are not getting back to running. So CFI, they're also seeing a lot of amputation at the same time. And these individuals that are having their legs amputated are getting a prosthesis and getting back to running. So for a lot of the limb salvage group, they were opting for this delayed amputation, and they'd get a prosthesis so they could get back to running. So it was this, kind of non-logical thought process of, I'm going to cut my leg off so I can get back to running, and it may not actually improve my outcomes. So trying to find a solution to that, the first thing they did was they built a brace, and it was called the IDEO brace. So here's one of the guys that had been blown up downrange. He had an ankle fusion. And then we get this brace. And this brace was carbon fiber and Kevlar. It was really rigid. They had to have a lot of strength to be able to, really push off that brace. You had to midfoot strike and drive that thing into the ground to get return from it. And it really improved the function for the folks that were keeping their limbs. But it didn't solve the problem. In 5 years, 625 individuals got this brace, and there was still this big delayed amputation rate. So, trying to figure out why, we start looking at muscle, because we are kind of losing this battle for strength, and we can say that across the spectrum of rehab. But for trauma, you typically can't get them back to the loads that we need to put on muscle. So looking at what was different with a prosthesis, we've got this red line here, and when we're going through the stance phase of walking and we're accepting that load, we need a lot less strength from the thigh when we've got a prosthetic that's giving us some of the return. With an intact limb or with this IDEO brace, we need a lot more strength, and we just didn't have it. So it seemed like strength was our big problem. The second group was what we called the volumetric muscle loss group, or the VML group. This was a big part of that population that was suffering these traumatic injuries, and even just the gunshot wounds, if we had a little bit of muscle missing, that was a very disabling injury. So they determined that the CFI, that as many as 92% of the muscle conditions that were coming through could fit into this VML group. So they were trying to find solutions to essentially regrow muscle from scratch. And this is where, you know, it's funny to hear Johnny talk about it. He acts like he was dumb before this, but this is where we have to really take that deep dive down the physiology rabbit hole to become the physiology experts. You have to understand muscle really well to be able to try and grow it from scratch. So they were doing these extracellular matrices. They were taking this visceral tissue from a pig and scraping it of the cells that identified it as visceral, leaving this matrix material, and they would input it elsewhere in the body, and they could try and regrow tissue based on its location. So they would regrow some tissue for these full thickness muscle injuries. And so it was a really cool application. It's about to scale up to human application. It's really been mainly done with animals. So beyond that, bringing it back to reality, at the same time, we're seeing a lot of general orthopedics as well. So in 10 years of war, they estimated 50,000 ACL surgeries coming through the DOD. So we're seeing a lot of these ACL injuries at the CFI as well. And the problems that we see post-operatively and the problems that we see post-trauma are very much the same. The physiology doesn't change. It's just the time frame and the scale that seems to be different. So a lot of the lessons we learned from trauma and regenerative medicine approaches for volumetric muscle loss, we can apply to general orthopedics as well. So, looking into what we know is necessary for muscle change, we've got our 11th commandment here, our gold standard for muscle strength and hypertrophy, ACSM guidelines. And depending on which resource you look at, it might say 65 or 75% to 85% of your one rep max for 12 to 16 weeks for strength and hypertrophy. We all know that. It's been beaten into our heads. This works. This is our gold standard. We know this is a great way to approach muscle. But in rehab, we don't get here, at least not in the time frames that we typically have on the PT side. Maybe as we get a little bit more chronically out, yeah, we're going to start loading them. We're going to get back to this model of lifting heavy. And we don't have these alternate guidelines that tell us, or you could do these really light TheraBand exercises and ankle weight exercises, and that's the same thing. So we kind of, you know, we're lying to ourselves a little bit, at least in you know, at the CFI, we were doing the same thing. You know, you bring in these guys, these physiologists from the lab, and you're like, we're really having trouble putting on muscle. All right, well, show us what you're doing. Well, I've got this person doing these straight leg raises, and then we're doing this lightweight knee extension because that's all they can tolerate. And so they're like, so what is that? Well, that's strengthening. It really looks like you're doing range of motion. So they're like, you call it strengthening, call it whatever you want, but you're not making changes for the muscle. So this is where we need to find a different way. This was not effective. We know from the research that this doesn't create lasting change for strength. So this is where BFR came into the picture for us. So we can try and take the ideas and the physiology from heavy lifting, and we're trying to recreate that with our light load. So I'm going to pause this here in just a second so we can talk about it, if it'll let me, without getting this other slide in the way. And of course it won't. All right, we'll try that again. So, when we lift heavy, our muscles contract hard enough that we are going to limit or block arterial inflow distally into that limb. And that's what we're trying to recreate here with this tourniquet application. All right, there we go. So you go get in that squat rack, you're lifting 75 to 85% of your one rep max, you get that weight off the rack and you start accepting that load with your muscles, and your muscles are squeezing those arteries deep down by the bone, and we're gonna get oxygen deficient with our exercise. We've gotta dig really deep into that physiology that we left behind of Krebs cycle versus Corey cycle, that anaerobic metabolism. Yeah, you got to, that's a long way back there, isn't it? So in the Krebs cycle, we're oxygen rich, we're path of least resistance. We're going to stay in that Krebs cycle unless we have to change. So when we get out of that Krebs cycle, we get into the Corey cycle or that anaerobic metabolism, we start to build up these metabolites. We've got this lactate and hydrogen that we build up, or that acidic response that we all know and hate. And that seems to be a big part of what tells your brain, okay, we're working hard enough now that we need to adapt for the next time that this stress happens. Because we're still hunter-gatherers as far as evolution is concerned. If we don't do something stressful enough and then have the calories on board to support it, we're not going to put on muscle. And it may be different for some people than others as far as how much stress we need, but everyone needs stress for muscle to change. That's a standard. That isn't changing here. So we're going to try and mimic heavy load by using this tourniquet. We're not trying to create full occlusion. We're not doing surgery, so we want partial occlusion. In order to do that, we have to take a full occlusion measurement to create a baseline, and then we're going to try and apply a percentage of that. Based on the biggest effect sizes in research, it looks like 80% restriction for the leg and 50% restriction for the arm are where we see the biggest response as far as metabolites and muscle activation or IEMG within an exercise. So if we put enough pressure to limit arterial inflow, we're going to be blocking venous return. So all those metabolites we're building up, we're going to keep them there for as long as we're doing the exercise. The thing that makes this simple for us, there's two places that this cuff can go. It can go high on the thigh or high on the arm. It's all plumbing. So if you restrict it proximally on a limb, it's going to be restricted everywhere distally. You know, as much as everyone really seems to want that tourniquet that goes on the neck, we aren't really recommending that yet. When the studies come out, maybe we'll change our mind. So we're going to build up this metabolite response, and according to the research, 15 to 30% of a one rep max can look very similar to an 80% of one rep max. So 15 to 30% is a whole lot more attainable for us than an 80% is. So this is where we're applying this with that idea in mind. There's a lot of different pathways. If you get into the research, there's a ton of research. So we can look at some changes on the arterial side and then on the venous side as far as what seems to be happening and what we can look at from the research as the big players. The first thing is if you limit arterial inflow, we're going to see a change in those metabolites. We're going to get that lactate and hydrogen, and we're going to see a change in muscle activation. It looks like we're tapping into fast twitch out of necessity. You take oxygen down, slow twitch doesn't work so well for you. So we have to use those big torque-producing muscle fibers. When you build up a whole lot of lactate, we're going to see a hormonal response from that. So it looks like there's this direct correlation between lactate and growth hormone. And we can talk about clinical applicability or an idea for growth hormone from a recovery standpoint. We probably don't have time today, but maybe later after we get done with this. Same idea, hormonally, we see an increase in IGF-1 or insulin-like growth factor 1. That is probably one of our biggest growth hormones. That's one of the things that looks like it's dictating hypertrophy for muscle. And it's having an effect on these, what we call muscle satellite cells or myogenic stem cells. They're muscle progenitor cells. They're called PAX7s. They're the cells that proliferate and incorporate to either heal damaged muscle or incorporate to create a new myonucleus so we can have more protein reception for the muscle and we can make that muscle grow. So, protein synthesis, this mTOR pathway, seems to be one of the most important things for muscle at the end of the day. We have to make some changes for protein synthesis, or as like Johnny says, we've got to be protein synthesis ninjas in rehab. That's our biggest target. So, venous side, we create this pump effect. We're blocking some venous return, so we've got this extra fluid, and it looks like it really shifts into the muscle, and that's probably powerful for us for this protein synthetic response. We're also getting a reduction in stroke volume, so we're manipulating some of our exercise variables here. Heart rate's going to have to go up a little bit more than it normally would with this exercise because of that reduction in stroke volume. And then we're going to trap this metabolic stress for about 5.5 to 6 minutes for a strengthening exercise. We're up to 15 to 20 minutes for an endurance-based exercise. So, blasting right along here, there's been a lot of questions as to how much research is really out there. And there's a lot of it. It's been around for decades in the physiology labs. They use tourniquets to study anaerobic metabolism, so we've got a lot of studies that we can look at from the physiology side, and now the pathology side is starting to catch up to that. But looking back a couple years ago, there were about 706 papers out on BFR and exercise, and in the last 2 years, we've seen an explosion. So 2017. There were over 100 papers on blood flow restricted exercise that were published that year. And going through about 9 months of 2018, there were almost 200 articles. So we probably hit 200 articles last year just on this application with exercise. So there's a ton of information that we can pull from to create protocols and best practices. So that's great for us. And if we look at the big meta-analyses here, because there have been people that break this down for us, so we don't have to go into every single study, which is beautiful. And looking at the meta-analyses on effect size, if you compare light load, 20 to 30% of one rep max, to that same exact exercise, same set, same rep, same weight, with a tourniquet on, light load with a tourniquet wins every time for strength and hypertrophy. When we lift light, we have an effect size of zero for strength. Do the same thing, we've got this very significant effect size for strength that seems like it's pretty close to what we get with heavy. We're never going to replace heavy, so don't take it as that. We're not trying to. But if you can't lift heavy, it looks like this might be a good surrogate for us to get back to heavy. Then, hypertrophy, unfortunately, lifting light weights doesn't make anybody swole. So, do the same thing, put a tourniquet on, and we've got this very significant effect for hypertrophy that in the studies that have a comparison to heavy, we probably get even a little more hypertrophy than heavy load because we're not seeing as much tissue breakdown because it's not heavy. So, looking at a more recent meta-analysis here, this provides a good summary of the physiology stance on BFR, Josh Sliz's group. 20 to 30% of a one rep max or light intensity, like walking on a treadmill, which would not typically create any considerable change for us for muscle. When we apply a tourniquet, we make that anaerobic, all of a sudden we've got this exaggerated response for strength and hypertrophy. We see strength and hypertrophy changes from walking on a treadmill or doing light intensity on a bike. Goes against everything I thought I knew about physiology. So, more recently here, we've got this group in the UK, Luke Hughes and Steve Patterson. They did a meta-analysis systematic review on clinical application, and it looks like this has got a big clinical application base, but we've got to really focus on our individualization of this application. People have different pressures, and in a medical setting, we've got to treat this as something that has a risk, because it does. So we've got to do this in an individualized way so we know that we're applying minimal effective dose to minimize adverse risks. So, getting into this, one of the things I love about working with Johnny is he's a very in-depth basic science guy, and I try to be. I have to be by proxy to Johnny. And so he really wants to define the problem. And that's really made me a better clinician because of that definition of the problem. And so when we look at the problem we see in rehab, obviously we see these very significant changes in muscle that happen early after injury or after surgery during those periods of disuse. So when we look at this, it looks like this is tied to a protein synthetic response. We think about that muscle protein synthesis for the muscle as kind of being the regulator of how much muscle we have. And we've got this net protein balance equation here. So our net protein balance is equal to muscle protein synthesis minus muscle protein breakdown. So we've got this protein synthesis, you know, sinusoidal weight flow that happens throughout the day. It looks like we peak every 3 to 4 hours. And then we've got breakdown that kind of offsets that. And if we're doing the same kind of activities that we're used to, when we're taking in the same kind of calories that we're used to, we're going to stay pretty homeostatic as far as muscle. We're going to maintain muscle. But when we have an injury, and we go into this disuse model where they take healthy people in these studies and they cast them in 30 degrees knee flexion and have them non-weight bearing on one side for 2 weeks. In 2 weeks of disuse, we lose about 30% of our protein synthesis in that limb that's affected. It's not systemic, it's in the limb that we're actually doing less with. That corresponds to about a 350 gram loss of tissue. So because we're on, you know, not using grams for our measurements, we think of things in pounds, we need something to relate that to. That's about the size of the average heart. 300 to 310 grams is about the average heart, so we're losing as much or more than our heart from our thigh in the first 2 weeks of disuse, which we all see. I mean, you see that quad just turn to mush before your eyes. And on healthy people, they can test for strength. That's about a 30% loss in strength in 2 weeks. So, this is one of our big problems here. They call this anabolic resistance because we can take in all the protein we want. We're not going to offset this without some sort of muscle stress. So it doesn't look like this is happening in a day. There's questions on how quickly does it happen. One day doesn't seem to make a big change, but 1 week of disuse, we see some really bad things happening. We kind of go to hell in a handbasket in a week of disuse. So 1 week, we lose 3.1 pounds of muscle. So to give you perspective there, that's as much muscle as it would take 12 weeks or more of progressive overload to gain back. So this is one of our big issues here, right? And unfortunately, it's not complete disuse that's causing this. It's even reduced activity. You take healthy people and you reduce their step count. We see this same drop in protein synthesis and loss in muscle, loss in strength. So the groups that are researching this, the biggest one that really pushed this at first was NASA, because obviously they deal with these stress-deficient environments. So they'll put big, heavy pieces of equipment like this on the space station to try and combat that loss in muscle. I used to think of their biggest problem as bone density, which that is a problem, but they're more worried about what's happening to muscle. So your fun fact of the day is they used to have this on one side of the space station, so that way they could exercise, but it would create enough torque on the space station, it would start to spin it out of orbit, so they would need fuel to bring them back into orbit. And now they put it on opposite sides and have people exercise at the same time so it offsets. So, looking at this, again, I mentioned this earlier, we need to be protein synthesis ninjas. We've got to figure out a way to turn on protein synthesis with our exercise. That means it's got to be stressful enough that we have to respond. Doing a light load exercise, like 20% of one rep max knee extension, doing 75 reps, a whole lot of reps, we don't see a change in protein synthesis in young, healthy people. Do that same thing with a tourniquet on, make it anaerobic, we've got this significant increase. So 46% a few hours out from exercise. Anabolic resistance, if we're at a 30% deficit, one exercise, 46% increase, that might take somebody from losing muscle to being a lot closer to maintaining muscle. We see the same thing in an elderly population where it's even harder to make these protein synthetic changes happen. One exercise, knee extension, 20% of one rep max, 3 hours out, we've got a 56% increase when we put a tourniquet on compared to no change when we do that exercise by itself. So there are changes with this that are not just acute changes. We look at these changes over a period of time, and it's one bout is not going to do anything significant for you. We're looking at a cumulative response. You've got to do this consistently over time to see muscle accretion happen. So, looking at this, we look at these acute changes. We all think of that acute window that we need to take in our protein, and that's the most important thing to us, that 1 hour anabolic window that everyone's disproving now. So, we see these changes happen acutely, but if we're tracking this for a longer period of time, we actually see the biggest increase in protein synthesis about 24 hours out from our exercise. And so with this has changed our idea of a home exercise program. Our light load by itself is not really doing a whole lot for muscle, but we can do this in our rehabs. And then guess what? Tomorrow or the next day, you're gonna come back in, we're gonna do this again. So part of your home exercise program now is take in your protein. Home exercise program, in my mind, is now more geared toward tendon than it is to muscle. I don't think we're making a lot happen for muscle, but we can probably make some stuff happen for collagen synthesis for the tendon. So that's a completely different discussion. I won't go down that road yet today. So looking at how we make these protein synthetic changes happen, I mentioned that muscle pump. And we see this big pump happen when we do this exercise, similar to what you get with a heavy lift. And so some people are hyper responders, like our friend here in the picture, where you can see that he's doing some stuff on the ball there, and he had this gigantic pump that would happen when he was doing this. And everyone's like, is that okay? Do we need to stop? Is that a bad thing? But it was localized to the muscle. We actually see this shift in fluid happen to the muscle. And we know from studies that this seems to have a sparing effect on muscle loss. You take that anabolic resistance study, immobilize people for 2 weeks, control group does nothing. The group that does BFR does nothing, but you just put a tourniquet on and inflate it and deflate it 5 times for 5 minutes. Just by putting a tourniquet on and inflating it every day for 2 weeks, control group lost 30% of their knee extensor strength. Put a tourniquet on and do nothing, 10%. Hamstrings, 19% lost in the control group. Put a tourniquet on and do nothing, 3.5%. Plantar flexors, 16% lost in the control group. Put a tourniquet on and inflate it, nothing. So being able to spare muscle loss just by inflating and deflating a tourniquet, which we hardly ever do. We're gonna do some sort of exercise, but it looks like this inflation-deflation pattern of a tourniquet can be powerful for us. Same thing postoperatively. Post-op ACL, day 3 to day 14, both groups doing standard of care, range of motion, mobilization, isometrics, conservative. And then one group just puts a tourniquet on and inflates it 5 times for 5 minutes after each treatment for the first 2 weeks, and they lost half as much of their quad. So, when we look at this, we're looking at this pump as a very good target for us. We can mimic these studies by doing 4 or 5 inflation cycles with a tourniquet, and if nothing else, we're gonna make this pump happen. So, looking at our acute management of injuries, even if we can't target the affected area, we can work up the chain. We can make that thigh and hip work for us. So we'll apply some exercises there. We're gonna hit our really simple conservative stuff that we have available, and we might even load it with some ankle weights, and we're gonna make something significant happen for this pump, and we're probably gonna salvage a whole lot of the muscle that we would have lost. All right, so looking beyond that, unfortunately, especially with our kind of low-hanging fruit injuries here, it's not just a disuse atrophy that's our problem, right? If we think about our ACLs and our Achilles tendon rupture repairs, you know, we've got this muscle that doesn't ever really seem to come back to the way it was before. Some do, but we've got a lot of those muscles that just never really come back. You know, we can all think about those non-responders where you do everything you can, you're throwing 5 exercises on that quad and you just cannot get that quad to respond. And so ACLs is where the majority of the research is for this, and looking at this persistent weakness that we see, you know, historically it's been blamed on neurophysiology. I mean, we've got these decreased firing patterns, we're not, you know, recreating that firing pattern. And acutely, yeah, we're seeing some of those changes, but that doesn't give a good explanation for long-term detriment. So now we're seeing these very cool studies coming out of University of Kentucky where they are taking people and they're doing muscle biopsies after an ACL injury. So you're looking at an injured VL and a non-injured VL on the same person, and there are cellular differences between those muscles because of that injury to the ACL. So you take somebody before they even have surgery and you do a biopsy of their quad, we start to see a reduction in these satellite cells. It's really hard. I'll zoom in here so we can see this a little bit better. So, looking at this, what they found is we've got a reduction in satellite cells, which are those myogenic stem cells or muscle progenitor cells. Those are our biggest help for repair and growth for muscle. We've also got this increase in an extracellular matrix, or what we think of as a fibrotic response in the muscle. We start to lay down some scar, which we're going to get to here in a few minutes. But this satellite cell reduction needs to be a big target for us, because if we don't have those satellite cells proliferating and incorporating, we're not going to get that muscle to grow. So, looking at this, it's not just our fast twitch. You know, a lot of times we think of this response as being more so we're having this fast twitch atrophy, we're keeping a lot of our type 1s, and it looks like we're seeing a reduction in both for atrophy and for the reduction in these satellite cells. It's not fiber specific. So, with these satellite cells, they're quiescent on the outside of the muscle fiber, and if we do something that's significant enough for a hormonal response and we get IGF-1, we can get those to proliferate and we can get them to incorporate, and they're either gonna heal damage or they're gonna incorporate onto that muscle for a new myocyte, a new muscle cell, and a new place to do protein synthesis. So, if we look at our exercise, we wanna know that we can target these, and it looks like we can in a very significant way. We got Jacob Nielsen's group here and Per Aargaard, they're over in Norway. They have a high-end physiology lab and they did this 3-week study. And it's a high frequency every day, twice a day, almost every day, of knee extension. Light load, 30% of 1 rep max. You do that with a tourniquet or without a tourniquet. And they did biopsies pre, mid-training, 3 days post, and 10 days post to look at the changes in the muscle. So, looking at light load by itself, they saw no change. And 10 days post, those myogenic stem cells or those PAC7s are actually nowhere to be found. Doing the same thing with a tourniquet, you make this anaerobic, all of a sudden we've got this very significant response for both type 1s and type 2. So we've got this proliferation and incorporation. This is the number of satellite cells that fused, or the new myocytes or myonuclei that we have on that fiber. So this is a powerful thing for us because we're seeing a very significant hypertrophy from this. 3 weeks, they had a 30 to 40% hypertrophy of the thigh. Traditional heavy load lifting for untrained individuals, 12 to 16 weeks is typically about 15 to 20% hypertrophy. So very significant hypertrophy. And to go along with it, we're seeing strength change. It looks like these myogenic stem cells, if we get those to incorporate, that's where we see true adaptation for muscle. So from pre to 5 days post, the group that had a tourniquet on got significantly stronger. Then, a week later, detraining, not doing any exercise, they continued to get stronger. So if we do something that's significant enough to make this response happen, we're going to see some strength change from that. All right. So this is where we've seen a big push from this. That group at Kentucky, Chris Fry and Brian Noren, are now doing a big NIH-funded study for ACLs where they're applying this to a standard of care to look at the difference in long-term, well, short-term and long-term outcomes for the ACL. So this is one of like 9 ACL trials that are ongoing right now, so we should have a ton of information on ACLs in the next few years here beyond what we already have. To go along with that, obviously, we've got the orthobiologics that are the big thing right now, right? Everyone's doing these PRP and stem cell injections, and so there's some research that's going on for this at Andrews and Gulf Breeze, and so we've got some preliminary information from that where they're doing 3 or 4 exercises right before they do their antecubital draws. So 3 to 4 exercises on the leg, then do a blood draw from the arm. And what they're finding is we've got this very significant increase in lactate, which we all know that's going to happen because we're making this exercise anaerobic. And then to go along with that, we've got this spike in these mesenchymal progenitor cells, what we think of as a cell that can differentiate into a lot of different things. So this can have benefit for us. This is what, we call it stem cells, but beyond mid-30s, stem cell is a misnomer, progenitor cell. And so we've got a spike in these little stem cells from doing exercise. So they're doing this before all of their blood draws now, before they do these PRP and stem cell injections. So very cool, waiting for this to be published. So it'll be, I'm sure it'll be a hot article when that comes out. I mentioned the scar pathway because we've got this problem for reduction in satellite cells, and it looks like the scarring may be a part of why that's happening. So when we have these ACL injuries, we've got these cellular changes that happen, and then we've got this different protein-rich environment. It's not this proliferative environment that we want. It's actually, we've got this environment that seems to inhibit growth. So we've got this TGF-beta family, which I think it's actually covered up there. But TGF-beta is this family of proteins that are involved in fibrosis. The main one that we look at for muscle is something called myostatin. So myostatin is something that's linked to atrophy of muscle. It's an inhibitor of muscle growth, and it's involved in scarring in muscle. So looking at that, there's been a lot of research on myostatin. These guys at Johns Hopkins took a mouse model and they isolated myostatin and knocked it out, thinking that it was going to allow for protein synthesis and they were going to make this mouse wither away and die. And it turns out it doesn't allow for protein synthesis. It blocks it. So the mouse didn't wither away and die. It got bigger. And so there are these animals that are bred to be myostatin deficient. We've got the Belgian blue here, and it just walks around and eats grass and puts on muscle. And I'm jealous. So we all know those people that look at weights and put on muscle. I'm sure there are some people that are myostatin deficient compared to others. But whether or not we think about this in our exercise prescription, we've got to get myostatin to downregulate in order for muscle growth to happen. It's part of what physiology we have to target. So we need to know if that's happening because we get this big growth response. So if myostatin doesn't go down, then it doesn't make sense. And luckily, some people have studied that. So Laurentino's group here did 8 weeks, 3 days a week, 80% of one rep max versus 20% of one rep max and 20% of one rep max with a tourniquet on. And guess what? You put a tourniquet on, we get a mimicked response to lifting heavy. Makes sense. So this has got implications for hypertrophy, and then it's also got implications for this scar pathway. There are docs right now that are giving pharmaceuticals to inhibit this scar pathway. Guys over at Stebbin Philippon and Vail and also Memorial Hermann are taking some losartan, having their patients take losartan, which is an angiotensin II receptor blocker. It acts like a beta blocker, and it reduces the TGF-beta pathway, and we see less scar. So they're actually inhibiting it pharmaceutically. We might be able to target that some with exercise. produce this response naturally. So, essentially, our patients need to be in beast mode. And we learn a lot of lessons from animals. You know, the animal models, people poo-poo on them because it's not a human model, but we can control animal trials. You know, there's really good controls, so we've got some good information coming from that. And learning from the rat models, because they looked at these rat models for muscle injury, and if you recreate a muscle injury in a rat and you let it do what it wants to, it's going to go run its little tail off on its wheel. They go back to high intensity and they heal really well. So if you look at an animal model or this rat model and look at a post-injury model, they've got a lot of healing. They don't have a lot of extra collagen or fibrosis that happens, and they've got this beautiful response because for them it's evolutionary. They're worried about surviving, so they go run their little tail off. We don't do that. We go into this pattern of disuse because it hurts. And so if you make that happen in an animal, then they have the same thing happen. We start to lay down a bunch of collagen and we get fibrosis, so you have to take their exercise away for it to happen. So this changed what they were doing with the military. They started approaching exercise with a higher intensity. So this has got a big implication for muscle and for bone. Bone needs stress, and even by doing this stuff, it still wasn't as effective as they needed it to be. So, this has really changed where this blood flow restriction seems to fill a gap. We look at acute management post-injury. We've got our BFR poster child here for Clowney, and he was the guy that really took this out of the military model. He had a second microfracture in Houston. They thought his career was going to be over, and ESPN introduced Johnny to the Texans, and he taught them how to put these tourniquets on and do this crazy stuff with rehab. So for his 6 to 8 weeks non-weight bearing after that microfracture, all of his mat exercises, he had a tourniquet. And in 6 weeks, he lost no thigh, which it helps that he's a freak of nature. But 6 weeks non-weight bearing is going to be death to your thigh. But at that point, it's not like, you know, all right, we did this microfracture. You didn't lose any of your size, so guess what? You get to just start loading it up. No, we've got to test that, you know, that tissue now. We've got to start loading a little bit. And so for us, it became this easy decision of, are we loading heavy? Yes, great, load heavy. If we're not, and we're trying to build strength, well, we're putting a tourniquet on for that exercise. So we're still using a tourniquet until that loading gets into the realm of that ACSM model. And this really seemed to change his progression back to play. So we see this in other individuals. Dwight, he was using it because he's got these big osteochondral lesions on both knees. And so he missed a lot of games in 2015. And the next year, using this for off-season and in-season management of load, he played 30 more games than he did the year before. So his knees didn't hurt. He kept some strength on. He kept some of that stress out of the joint. And then we see some crazy stuff like this. So this is an NFL defensive end, post-ACL, and he's 8 months post-ACL. So obviously we can tell which side's surgical and non-surgical. He's a freaking monster. And this quad just isn't coming back. He was about to get cut by his team. He went and saw somebody in Atlanta, and after 2 weeks of doing 5 days a week, twice a day, high frequency, that quad looks a little different. So I wish my legs responded like this, period. So 2 weeks, that's a huge difference. 1 month, he's almost back to baseline. So that's a pretty wild change in muscle. It's like the muscle woke up. I've heard a lot of people say this, and I believe it. It's like you have a cheat code for the muscle. You just figure out it gets down to that muscle and it starts to turn it on like it hadn't been before. And one of the things that we really kind of worried about at first was, if you look at the tourniquet literature, tourniquets, especially in surgery, are typically related to a pain response. We see increased pain from tourniquet application or post-tourniquet application. There's an increase in pain. So this was a concern at first. And we actually kind of see the contrary. So looking at this, we actually get an analgesic response, which can be beautiful for us in a lot of ways. If we think about clinically all the people that are inhibited by pain, we get a reduction in pain with this. Looking at an anterior knee pain model, people that have a patellotendinopathy type of presentation, pain with single leg squatting, both shallow and deep, and pain with a step down test, they did a within-session model here of, we're just going to do an exercise. Knee extension, 30% of one rep max, versus the same thing with a tourniquet, crossover model, so the groups change the next time they come in. And what they found was a 50% reduction in pain within session. So they are essentially starting to use this now to take pain down at the beginning of the session, and then, all right, let's just load them. So let's use this, take pain down, and then load a little bit more than we could tolerate before. Jill Cook's group in Australia took this and made it a chronic model, and we think of Jill Cook as the tendon whisperer. So Jill Cook's got some awesome information out there on tendon. If you're not familiar with her, I highly recommend her research. And so they took this model and did 3 days a week for 8 weeks, 70% of one rep max for the control group, because for tendon, we want to load it. You know, we all know that tendon responds to load for collagen synthesis and organization. And then they had this BFR group at 30% of one rep max. They looked at pain and then peak torque for knee extension on a Biodex. So after 8 weeks, BFR with 30% of one rep max, that group had 93% less pain than the heavy load group and trended toward significantly better knee strength. Subgroups, 20 in each group that had the worst pain coming in, the BFR group had 50% better peak torque for knee extension than the heavy load group. So there may be this potential to have less pain and more strength for a group that comes in and they're inhibited by pain for loading. So we wonder, is it the exercise or is it the tourniquet that's creating this analgesic response? And it looks like it's might be both. You know, there's good studies out there that exercise, if you can do it, it creates this hypoalgesia, or we get this, you know, decreased response to a noxious stimulus after exercise. So exercise is probably a powerful component. And then the tourniquet itself. This study at HSS, Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, they put a tourniquet on for 5 minutes, one round for 5 minutes before going under tourniquet for surgery. So control group did not have the tourniquet before, but was still under tourniquet for the surgery. After the surgery for 2 days, the group that had this 5 minute application of a tourniquet had significantly less pain with exercise. So very interesting. There's this idea of a preconditioning response, or that the tourniquet can create these significant changes for us. And that's what we're gonna look at here in a few minutes after we get through endurance. So we don't just look at this for strengthening, we look at this for a VO2 response as well. We use this with our endurance-based applications. And so if we think about our bike, that's not something that we typically get a lot of change with in rehab because we're probably not at a high enough intensity. You know, 50 to 100% of VO2 max is where we need to be for adaptive change for VO2. And the lower we are in that spectrum, the longer the intervention has to go. And in a rehab model, we're probably just not hitting the intensity we need for the amount of time we need. So Abe's group did a look at that, take a sub-threshold application, 40% of VO2 max, put tourniquets on the legs, 15 minutes, 3 days a week for 8 weeks, or no tourniquets, 45 minutes, 3 days a week for 8 weeks. And afterward, they looked at VO2 and time to exhaustion. Light intensity by itself, no change for VO2. Put tourniquets on, and we've got a 6.5% increase in VO2 max in 8 weeks. They had a significant increase in time to exhaustion, and we think of it as a lactate threshold. How hard can you go for how long? They also had a significant hypertrophy of their quad with light intensity on the bike, and they trended toward a significant increase in knee extensor strength. It didn't quite reach statistical significance. So one of those studies, you take it out a couple more weeks, we may hit that significant 0.05 we need. So this, again, goes against everything I thought I knew about physiology of getting VO2, lactate threshold, hypertrophy, and potentially strength at the same time. So we can see this from other studies, interval studies, where they're looking more at the performance side. This was 3 days a week for 4 weeks. They had different interval groups, high intensity, low intensity with BFR, and low intensity by itself. And they looked at VO2 max, peak power, lactate threshold, and knee extensor strength. And light intensity with BFR was the only group that made an increase in all four of those parameters: VO2, peak power, lactate, and strength. So that might be a very valuable application of time when you only have low intensity available. So we think about getting people back to return to play, return to run. If we can get that VO2 to stay up while they're not doing a whole lot, that's a good win for us if they're trying to get back to play. We also don't think about walking on a treadmill as being a very powerful application for us, especially in a trained population. So Air Force Pararescue, Air Force Special Forces here, highly trained individuals. This was a short model. It says 5 weeks, 3 days a week, but it's actually 3 weeks, 5 times per week. and this was walking on a treadmill. So it was started at a 1% grade, every 4 minutes went up by 1% until they got to 5%. And in 3 weeks, Air Force Pararescue significantly increased VO2 max, significantly reduced their mile and a half run, and had significant hypertrophy of their thigh from walking on a treadmill. So that's a big win if we're talking about a walking application. And we see this in a clinical model as well. If we look at our geriatric population, walking on a treadmill, 20 minutes, 5 days a week for 6 weeks, self-selected walking pace with tourniquets on. We've got this significant increase in knee extensor and knee flexor strength, so the quads and hamstrings got stronger, hypertrophy of the thigh, and then improvements in our functional outcomes. Stands and timed up and go got significantly better from this walking application. So we're seeing these strength changes, and in my mind, this is where we're gonna see the bigger application. Geriatric and sarcopenics. I love the application for sports. I love sports, but I think big picture, joint replacements and geriatrics is probably where we're gonna see this have the biggest impact. So we'll see that come along here, and I'm sure we're gonna see more and more in the near future. So, all right, we're getting close. So looking at this, I'm gonna talk about just the tourniquet application itself, this idea of a preconditioning response. They've been looking at this from the cardiovascular research, where by putting a tourniquet on a limb, they could find an effect on the heart muscle and a sparing effect if we had this ischemic response, like a myocardial infarction, heart attack. So this has now been rolled into musculoskeletal research. They're putting tourniquets on either before or after a high intensity insult and seeing a significant difference in the amount of tissue breakdown. So we look at Page and Patterson's article here. This is over in the UK at St. Mary's. This was a study that I'm glad I was not a part of. They did 100 drop jump box jumps. So let's create a whole lot of eccentric muscle damage. Control group lays there and does nothing for recovery. The group that puts tourniquets on 3 rounds for 5 minutes on both lower extremities. So they alternated one and then the other every 5 minutes. And by doing this, 3-round tourniquet application at full occlusion, high pressure. Afterward, they did this serial blood draw for creatine kinase or signs for tissue breakdown. And by putting the tourniquet on after exercise, creatine kinase didn't go up significantly. So it was like they spared the tissue breakdown. And then strength was back at 24 hours. So to be able to do something like that and have strength come back and not have these significant signs for tissue breakdown, that is a pretty crazy response. And they've seen this with other eccentric loading models as well. I mean, this might be a beautiful thing in season. You know, we might put Normatec out of business if there's more research like this. You know, don't put those Normatec boots on, just put a tourniquet on 3 times for 5 minutes and you're gonna have no muscle breakdown. So control group that didn't put tourniquets on, 72 hours, they're still weak. So if we're looking at baseball, basketball, hockey, really short-term, you know, recovery times, this might be a powerful thing to get people back to full strength by the time that next game comes around. That's good. All right, we'll skip that one. So that one was supposed to be a clinical application one. We've got WashU over in St. Louis that looked at this for a motor learning response. They put a tourniquet on the non-dominant arm 5 times for 5 minutes for 7 days straight and tested dynamic standing balance 2 weeks and 4 weeks later and found a significant difference by putting a tourniquet on the non-dominant arm. So there may be this big neuro potential. They're looking at things like vascular endothelial growth factor as a way to elicit a neurogenic response. So I'll stop going down that rabbit hole right now so I can get into safety. So tourniquets are a foreign thing in exercise. No one really thinks at first without hearing about this and the effects that tourniquets with exercise are a great idea. So obviously there are some risks that come with tourniquets. So I hope the first thing that comes across everyone's mind is, what do I need to know about safety and how do I make this objective before I go start tying everybody off with knee wraps for exercise? Because there's a reason that physicians don't use knee wraps in surgery. So we'll look at that here. Looking at this, the biggest question that seems to come across everyone's mind is, what about things like clotting? Because we think about post-surgically, we've got this increased risk for DVT or VTE afterward. Is that because they were under tourniquet for surgery? And it looks like it's not. So if we look at this, there are studies where they compared going under tourniquet versus no tourniquet for surgery And whether you have a tourniquet on or not, you've got the same incidence for DVT or VTE. It doesn't seem to be linked to the tourniquet. It's probably linked to the fact that you're laying on your back for a long time in surgery and then laying on your back for a long time after surgery. It's stasis that seems to cause clotting. And kind of counterintuitive to that is the tourniquet itself. When we look at this inflation and deflation of a tourniquet, our body's natural response to this short-term pooling and ischemia is we've got this fibrinolytic protein that comes out. We've got this thing called TPA antigen that comes out that's this slick stuff that's probably beneficial for us. So, looking at this, we want to look at blood markers. We've got things like fibrinogen, which would be a direct sign for clot, or D-dimer or CRP, which would be downstream markers for clot. We want to know what's happening acutely, what happens with one bout. So if we go through that really quickly, if we look at young healthies, if we look at 24 hours of bed rest or doing this at altitude, or elderly subjects or subjects with ischemic heart disease, doing one bout doesn't seem to create any kind of increased risk for those blood markers. We don't see fibrinogen go up. We don't see D-dimer go up. We don't see CRP go up. We don't even see these reactive oxygen species or free radicals go up. So it looks like there's not a lot of vascular stress that's happening. So what about if we do this chronically? Well, we've got 4 weeks in young healthies. We've got 12 weeks in the elderly on lower extremity, 12 weeks in the elderly on upper extremity, or 4 weeks postoperatively. And doing this for multiple bouts over a period of time, we still don't see any of those blood markers go up. In this post-op study here, this was a DOD study where they did bilateral duplex ultrasounds on both groups, so 60 to 90 minute ultrasounds on both legs, and no changes to be found in either group, no signs of coagulation. And so that looks like we're probably at a very low, if no risk for clotting. There's never been a reported event of BFR and a clot in the research or clinical application. So it looks like that's a very low risk. On top of that, we've got this fibrinolytic system that kicks in, TPA antigen. Same thing happens if you lift heavy. Our body's response over time is if you have this temporary pooling of blood, guess what? You're gonna release this slick stuff, whether we have any kind of sign for clot or not. That's been corroborated in multiple studies here. So we see that after one bout, we see that after multiple bouts. All right, so application. We're probably gonna go a little over on time, so I'm sorry. So looking at this, one of the important things for us in the DOD, they said, guess what? Tourniquets are FDA listed medical devices. Anything that restricts blood flow into a limb, whether it's full or partial occlusion, that is a tourniquet. So if you're going to be doing this in a medical setting, we need to use a medical device. And they said, we've got to mirror what these physicians do in the OR because they are doing this the safest way possible based on years of application and engineering for tourniquet application. So we've got to look at minimal effective dose. The biggest risks we run into with tourniquets comes from high pressure and long duration application. And the way we get a minimal effective dose is we take into account limb occlusion pressure. So that is how much pressure we need for full occlusion. There are a lot of different variables that can affect that. Race, gender, limb circumference, tissue density, blood pressure, the type of cuff that you use, where you place it, all those things can affect how much pressure you need. So we've got to take all those things into account. So we were doing handheld Dopplers at first, and now we've got a system that has a Doppler technology built into the cuff. So when we look at this, cuff width really matters. The wider the cuff, the less pressure you need to have the same effect. So we're not using narrow cuffs because high pressure is a bad thing. So we're using these big wide cuffs so we can take the pressure down to this side of the curve. If we look at this, compared to some of the other things out there, the things that have become popular are a lot of these narrow cuffs with the hand pump. And if we look at that, they're safe because we can go up to 500 millimeters of mercury and we've still got arterial inflow and some venous return. One, it's called blood flow restriction. So if you're not restricting the blood flow, I don't really know why you're putting a tourniquet on somebody. And also, if we put a whole lot of pressure on, then we have a problem for our nerves, because that's the biggest risk with tourniquets, is the risk for a nerve palsy. And that comes from a big pressure gradient. If you put a big pressure on with a narrow cuff, we've got this very high pressure and we've got a very high pressure gradient. Whereas a wider cuff needs less pressure, and because it's spread out over a bigger surface area, we've got lower gradients that go along with that. So looking at the surgical research, biggest risk that comes from tourniquets is the risk for nerve injury. High pressure gradients, you can actually demyelinate a nerve or create a nerve palsy. So If you're going to do this, do it with a wide cuff and please measure the pressure you need. That will be a very big thing for minimizing your liability. And also, if we think about this, it makes sense that these people would need different pressures, right? Just like we're probably going to be lifting different weights with these individuals, I think of the application of pressure the same way. I want to know how much pressure I need to have the best effect, because we're not going to let Grandma Smith go lift a weight and say, it could be like 75 pounds, it might be 20, but yeah, you'll be fine. Just go with it. So the amount of pressure we use matters. If we look at the studies, we've got studies like this where in women that have this precursor for knee osteoarthritis, they're set up to have osteoarthritis. We've got an application of pressure that was a set pressure with a set cuff. It was arbitrary, and guess what? It had an effect. It was beneficial for them. Then they use the exact same protocol with a male cohort. Males typically need more pressure, and guess what? The same protocol for males, it wasn't effective. So people were saying, well, maybe BFR is effective for women, but it's not effective for men. Or maybe your pressures just didn't make sense for the population you were studying. So we look at the methods really mattering. So we look at this. That also matters for the response we have within exercise. We see an increase in IEMG with specific pressures. This is 80% versus 60 and 40 for the lower extremity. And 80% pressure had the highest IEMG for the rec fem and for the VMO during a knee extension exercise. So we want to know that we're turning on the most muscle possible with our single exercise application. I want fatigue and I want to use a lot of fast twitch. That's where we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck. All right, so I'm going to jump through a couple here because I know we're running out of time. Looking at this, again, we need something that regulates our pressure. We use the device we do because, you know, with the military, JAG lawyers wouldn't let us use something that wasn't medical. And on top of that, the engineering is there to where we have a microprocessor that actually monitors the pressure and adjusts it within exercise. So the pressure we start with and the pressure we end with is the same versus if we have a cuff pressure that's here to start. If you don't have something that adjusts, pressure in the limb is going to go up. So the pressure from the cuff to the skin goes up. And so this is a study out of the UK where they put sensors under the cuff and they had a cuff that adjusted and one that did not. So we're going to rely on the engineering that's been there for the surgical literature. We've carried that over to a rehab application. This is really exploded with research. This is just the stuff that we're involved with. It's about 26 ongoing trials. There's about, you know, $6.5 million of grant-funded research that Johnny's helped to stimulate. Everything from fractures to ACLs to total joints. We've got some stuff on tendinopathy. They're actually looking at mitochondrial responses with this, so we're getting deep science with it. Orthobiologics, and we're seeing this grow and grow. We're seeing more of the cardiovascular stuff and stroke research from University of Miami in North Texas. So this is an ever-expanding application base. It looks like for the vast majority of our folks, it's safe outside of people with big cardiovascular compromise and severe hypertension and an active clot. Beyond that, we're pretty much not seeing a whole lot of contraindication to use. So this has exploded. We've worked with about 200 pro and college teams. We've worked with the majority of the DOD, and it's kind of growing throughout the DOD. Lots of hospital systems are now doing this, and then we're now US, Canada, the UK, the Netherlands, about to be Taiwan and Italy for education. So this is a really quickly growing application. All right, best resource here, if you're looking for a single resource to review or pass along, this is Techniques in Orthopedics. It's an orthopedic surgical journal that did an entire rehab journal edition, which is, you know, not very common. So they did, you know, 6 new articles on BFR. If anyone needs full text for this, I'd be happy to pass it along. So this is great. If you're looking to talk to doctors, it's in an orthopedic surgical journal. So it's a great resource that isn't a rehab or physiology journal that you're trying to get them to buy into. So on top of that, Techniques in Orthopedics. This is from Brian Day, who's the past president of the Arthroscopy Association, and a group over at Howard Head and Stedman Philippon. This are some very recent articles. A few months ago, they came out. Good stuff on where it fits into post-operative applications. So good review on what they're doing there.